And our guest is?
Jed Jaworski.
Tell us a little bit about your story, right?
I've always been enamored of the Great Lakes, having grown up in Wisconsin. I was born in Madison in a very rural, idyllic rural environment, and then in the first grade plunked in the middle of a very dense urban suburban environment, which I never really adapted to. So growing up in Milwaukee, looking east was always the direction that appealed to me, the open horizon. And every day as a kid, I would see these steamboats coming over the horizon to and from Milwaukee and disappearing over that eastern horizon. And I recognized the same boats would be coming every day. And so eventually I found my way down to the harbor and realized that they were the Grand Trunk and Chesapeake and Ohio Railway steam car ferries. And I said to myself, one of these days, I'm going to get on one of those boats, and I'm going to see what's on the other side of the horizon. So at 13 years old, I managed to talk my parents into letting me take a mini cruise for $13. You could have a couple meals and a trip over to Ludington and back. And once I saw the Michigan shoreline, I was all in. During the early high school days, would come over to camp in Ludington State Park, and I wanted to immerse myself in Great Lakes maritime history, and the steamboats were disappearing quickly. So I got my mariner's papers and shipped out on the Grand Trunk ferry. And that fall, when I was discharged from the ship, I decided I was going to hike up to Frankfort and see the other ferries I had heard about that were operating out of Frankfort, Alberta Harbor. So I hiked up the beach, eventually up the bluff into Alberta. I arrived here first as a beach walker, not as a highwayman.
Right.
So I was really surprised when I came up over the hill, and sure enough, there was this very sleek, modern ferry, more modern looking than the steamboats that were running out of Milwaukee. And it seemed quite out of place in a harbor with forested hills and not a lot of space. It was a big ship in a small harbor. And after looking the ship over, I walked to the causeway where the two white propellers are, right? They were there in 19, this would have been 1976, I believe. There was a big peach painted on a plywood sign, and it said, "Welcome to Alberta, a peach of a place." And we had to cross the railroad tracks then, which came across M-22. And I walked across that causeway towards Frankfort, and I saw a wild apple tree. And I went to pick an apple for a snack, and suddenly a window flew up on a house a few hundred feet away. And a woman shouted out at me, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm really sorry. I said, I thought this was just a wild tree." She goes, "It is. You don't want to eat that apple." She goes, "If you're hungry, come on in the house. I'll make you a sandwich." So I took her up on the offer, and it turned out that was the wife of the captain of the car ferry Viking, Chuck Novak. And when she heard of my interest in all things maritime, she says, "Well, you need to stay just a few hours until my husband gets in on the boat. He'll have enough time to run up to the house, and I'd like for you to meet him." So I had the privilege of meeting Chuck Novak, and he said, "Well, you know, if you're interested in working on the ferries," he says, "here's the person you should talk to, and seems like you would be a good addition to the..."
So they lived in Alberta?
And they lived right on River Road, so I guess that would technically be Crystal Lake Township.
Right.
Yeah, it was the first,
first
house
too.
On the right as you head east on River Road. So I ended up applying, but they couldn't hire me immediately. This was a union back then. These were high-paying union jobs, and there were a lot of people applying for them. So I ended up taking a job with Nugent Farms, and they asked me if I wanted to work in the plant on Forrester Road or if I wanted to work on the farm, and I said the farm. So I went up to Chester Nugent's farm, and it was also the quintessential, you know, what you think of as farm life. It had the old squeaky windmill in the yard by the big maple tree, and a white farmhouse with a barn right across from it, and I very much enjoyed learning the ways of fruit farming. Chet was a very kind, gentle man, and he allowed me to stay in a migrant housing unit, so I had a place to call my own. And then a little later, when we were picking some peaches in an orchard, I looked down into this beautiful 40-acre valley, and I saw an abandoned house down in it. It used to be the old Ben Cairn farm. He was a man who raised some of the finest horses back in the day for logging operations and whatnot back in the day. And I asked around to find out who owned that. It turned out the Nugents owned it. So I said, is there any chance I could rent that house in that valley to spend the winter here, because I wouldn't be able to work on the farm during the winter months? And so they said, sure. And I had my first winter alone in a
farmhouse.
Got the chimney repaired just in time for the first snow. And then eventually I was able to get to position aboard the ferries. And
so were they raising horses on that property?
Back
that
in the day, yeah.
Not when you lived there, but mm-hmm. It was where you lived there.
He was the classic Norwegian bachelor farmer, and heard many interesting stories about him. He always wore a heavy dark wool overcoat, even in the summer, and he could pitch a bale of hay up over his head even in his late years, and never married. The story was that he finally had to come into the hospital here, and for the first time in his life, he had the attentions of a woman. And on his deathbed there at the hospital, he said, all my money's buried out at the farm. I want you to have it. And apparently, that story, I've been told, is true, because she told a lot of people about it, and then she had to pay a ridiculous amount of taxes.
But, it was the nurse.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And in fact, there was a hole chipped in the floor of the chicken coop where supposedly the jar of money was buried. I was here early enough to get a lot of that lore, you know, from the logging era.
Right.
Louis DeLong, he used to salvage deadhead logs out of the Betsy River, and that he was quite elderly, and he told me a lot of stories about, you know, the logging days. But this was a very different place, even in the 1970s. When I came here, the railroad still came into Frankfort. The tracks split on the other side of the causeway, so it was actually possible to get stuck on the causeway, because you could have a train on either side. But having to wait for a train in this neighborhood, whether you were in Beulah or Frankfort, Alberta, that was just an everyday occurrence, because freight trains were constantly coming and going because of the ferries. And there were sidings that went into Frankfort to Petritz Foods, the lumber yard, the coal yard. The tracks ran all the way down parallel to Main Street, to just opposite the Garden Theater, what was behind then the Jacobson Marina and the hardware store.
Yeah, I've known people that worked for Petritz, too, which was a pretty major employer, I think, at one point.
Yep, there were a lot of good paying jobs to be had here then.
And we had that supply chain with the railroads.
And it's hard to imagine now, with Alberta being, you know, a quiet, essentially tourist-based economy. But, you know, back then, Alberta was the industrial side of the harbor. Most of the tourism was happening on the Frankfort side. They had the Petritz plant and the usual commercial businesses, but the industrial things were happening over here. And it not only looked, smelled, it also sounded like it. You had the constant rumble of the over-the-road locomotives and the switch engines idling all the time here in town, and that spinning sound they make when the air pressure is released frequently on them. When the trains came and went from in and out of town, that rumbled a lot of people's houses. And if you happen to be in Beulah, I think it was called Crystal Crate and Cargo. It was a gift store right by the railroad tracks. Every single thing in the store, they had a lot of glassware and everything, mm-hmm. would just rattle. But then you also had all night long, because apparently they could only haul this material over the roads at night because of DOT regulations, was all the liquid asphalt that was being stored in the tanks on the waterfront. And so if the sound of the ferry whistles and the booming of the train cars being pushed in and out of those cavernous halls wasn't enough, you had the sound of these massive tank trucks rolling in and out of Alberta all night long. And they weighed a lot. They had a tremendous number of tires on them. And so the turn off of Furnace Avenue onto M22 was always just raw, shiny asphalt from when these big trucks with these 18-plus wheels would try to make that tight corner. So there was a lot going on in Alberta then. We had Mix's gas station right opposite of that intersection, and you could still get gasoline and
so they worked on your car and you got gas there.
Yep. And you know, there weren't gift shops or anything really like that in Alberta, but we had Thomas's General Store, so you could get all manner of your groceries. You might have to get on a rolling step ladder with a reacher tool to get it off the very top shelf, but just about everything you needed in there was in that little store. And they had a wonderful meat market. And then if you were a railroadman or a car ferryman, you could get your overalls, boots, anything you needed for your workwear, for whatever your trade. And there were a lot of trades here too. It wasn't just the ferries and the crews, they had to be supported. So there was a commissary that had to bring all the food and everyday goods that would be used aboard the ship. There were people who worked in the rail yard repairing the locomotives. At that time, the old ironworks was a locomotive roundhouse. And so there were people constantly working in there, not only to maintain the railroad equipment, but also the car ferries. There was a marine repair shop, so they had welders and pipe fitters. And it was there was a lot of hustle and bustle and a lot of activity, a lot of people working in Alberta then.
Did you live on that farm for quite a long time?
I lived there until 1979. When I bought George Mant Farm just north of Frankfurt, and I've had that ever since I've been 21 years old.
So you came here like the first, I mean, you pretty much located here in 76, is that? And then you were at the farm.
And whether I live 6 miles out on Raymond Road on the Kieran Farm or whether I lived on the Mant Farm, it was easy to hear the car ferry call whistle. So, if you were off watch, you would have enough time to get your mail. And there were a lot of people who worked on the ferries then who actually had active farms, but they would work on the ferries, so they had one predictable good, you know, income, and then they would have their family or wives oversee the farm operation, the orchard operation.
Raymond Road's a little bit out there. Those whistles are loud.
Yep, they would. that sound of the ferry whistle would travel right up the river valley and through the hills, you know. So it was pretty easy to hear all over the immediate area. But that, you know, I could run out to my little farm and get whatever you needed, and then wait to hear the whistle, and that gave you 20 minutes to get back to the ship. Sometimes if you weren't lucky and the train had already blocked your access to the ferry landing, you would have to park your car on the other side of the railroad tracks and scoot through by walking around so you could get on the ship in time to leave.
So the Viking was an Ann Arbor ship.
Correct. Yep.
And you mentioned Grand Trunk, Chesapeake, and Ohio. What were those companies? Was it Grand Trunk and then Chesapeake and Ohio? They're three separate companies.
Yep, there were three different railroads, each operating a fleet of Cross Lake ferries. The Grand Trunk from Muskegon to Milwaukee, the CNO out of Ludington to Milwaukee. And then the Ann Arbor was running from Frankfurt to Kewaunee, also into Manitowoc.
Obviously, you got in. you got into Ann Arbor after that initial conversation and with... that was Captain Novak, correct?
Yeah, Bruce Jewell and Chuck Novak were the two officers on the ship at that time. So I had a brief amount of steamboating experience on the Grand Trunk Ferry, City of Milwaukee. And this was my first motor ship. And interestingly, the City of Milwaukee and the Ann Arbor Ferry Viking were sister ships. They were built to identical plans, nearly identical plans. But in 1965, the Ann Arbor No. 7 was converted to the car ferry Viking, and it had its steam engines replaced with the same engines, actually, that the locomotives used. It became an electromotive drive ship. So the engines made electricity that turned electric motors that turned the propellers. So it was quite an interesting experience the first time I walked aboard the ship, because there were sort of ghosts of the ship I had been working on, having been aboard its sister ship with all its beautiful varnished oak interiors and brass. And they had spray painted all of the oak with this horrible Smurf color blue.
Yikes.
Called chem-toned blue.
Ugh.
And so the former grandeur of the ship was kind of buried beneath a lot of unpleasant veneer. And unlike a quiet, you know, steam is the silent expansion of water molecules. So even though these ships have a tremendous amount of horsepower, they run almost silently. But on a motor ship,
it's not silent.
It's internal combustion. So there's explosions happening in every cylinder. So the ship is, even at the dock, it's just trembling. The railings are vibrating, and you can feel the deck vibrating under your feet. And it was heated electrically. And if you were on the top bunk in your room, it was too hot. If you were on the lower bunk, it was really cold, and your boots would often just freeze right to the deck. Because all they had were these little electric wall heaters. Where when the ship was steam, like on the City of Milwaukee, you know, all the decks were warm. They had a huge urn of hot coffee and porcelain mugs in the galley. But on the Viking, it was a little electric Mr. Coffee pot with a styrofoam cup, you know. Like on the City of Milwaukee, the galley stove was going all the time. It used to be a cast iron coal stove converted to oil. So the galley was always a warm and pleasant place to hang out, but on the Viking, it was all cold stainless steel, and when they shut the electric stoves off, it just became not a very warm place to have your cup of coffee between loading trains or something. But so it took a little bit of getting used to that ship, and it wasn't too long after I worked on the Ann Arbor that there was word that the Arthur K. Atkinson, which had been laid up, I believe, with a broken crankshaft, that the Detroit, Toledo, and Ironton was going to be converted into the Michigan Interstate Railway Company, and there was going to be a rebirth for the ferries in Alberta. And this town was pretty excited about that, mm-hmm. having the possibility of two ships running again and a future for the ferries. Because that was certainly in question. So eventually they got the Atkinson repaired, and there was quite a momentous day when the ship's bow was brought up to the loading apron, and with great ceremony, a bottle of champagne was crashed against the bow, and the ship was rechristened. And I got to be a part of the last rebirth of, you know, the Ann Arbor Cross Lake service. Eventually, I went from working on the Viking to the Arthur K. Atkinson. That was a ship that never felt entirely comfortable on it. It was only partially converted to a motor ship. In retrospect, it was not a successful conversion. It still had all the inefficiencies of steam in terms of fuel consumption. It used steam for the deck winches, for the heat, power plants for electricity, but the main engines were Nordberg non-reversing, and they had variable pitch propellers, which didn't give you full power backing up. And of course, the ferries need a lot of power to back into the ice. So the Atkinson was also built lighter than our other car ferries. It was never built for Lake Michigan service. The Ann Arbor bought it when it was being built for Lake Erie service. Two of its sister ships foundered. So that was not a ship that I slept well aboard on a stormy night. And there were a couple of close calls with that boat. And in fact, it actually had some plates buckle on it during a storm prior to my working on it. But then I was really excited when finally word passed around that the Ann Arbor was going to purchase, because the state was a partner now in the railroad, the former Grand Trunk Ferry City of Milwaukee. So the ship I had first worked on was going to be coming up here. So I immediately signed up to be part of the crew of the City of Milwaukee. I wanted to go back to steamboating, and I worked aboard the City of Milwaukee until the unfortunate demise of the Ann Arbor system. And when the City of Milwaukee was laid up, I lost my job. Only the higher seniority crew were able to operate the Viking for a short while longer, until the ferry service shut down in 1982.
And where did the Viking go?
Well, the three ships were tied side by side. in the Alberta rail yard. And the first to go, I believe, was the Viking. And it...
I saw remnants of the Arthur K. Atkinson up in, like, Menominee.
It ended up being scrapped in the Sioux.
Okay.
The Arthur K. Atkinson. The Viking bounced around a bit. Contessa Cruise Lines purchased it and took it to Lake Erie. It ended up eventually coming to K&K Warehousing in the Marinette Menominee River there. And that's where it ultimately was scrapped when their plans to use it for a pulpwood barge didn't materialize. So only the city of Milwaukee remains. And, of course, that was as a result of my love for that ship and the legacy of the Cross Lake Car Ferries, which began in Frankfort, Alberta. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that the reason the city of Milwaukee and the 17 structures that were on the property here in Alberta received National Historic Landmark designation is because the history of the Ann Arbor Railroad and the car ferries changed the course of our national history. The concept of taking rail freight, which is, of course, on wheels, and being able to roll that material right onto a ship and take it across to open and unprotected waters, high seas, heavy ice, and safely unload it quickly and efficiently on the other side was sort of the harbinger of what we now call roll-on, roll-off freight technology.
It seems kind of crazy when you think about it.
It was a huge challenge for any number of reasons. And prior to that, you know, there was a massive warehouse here in Alberta. And the harbor was still very much, you know, industrialized, but it was a different operation. It was called break bulk. So the train comes in to town. Whatever's in the train car gets unloaded into the warehouse, which is right along the waterfront. The ship comes in. It's then taken out of the warehouse and loaded into the hold of the ship. The ship travels to where it's going. Then it has to be taken out of the hold of the ship again, put in a warehouse, and then from the warehouse into a train or wagons. So this idea of just being able to roll something on and roll it off on the other side created a huge efficiency. But how do you overcome operating on Lake Michigan in the winter months? That's tremendous ice breaking. It's open, unprotected water. You know, wave heights can get to 25, 30 feet with a cargo on wheels. And then another challenge was, as you put the weight of the train car onto the ship obviously will lower itself in the water, severing its connection. So you have to have something that's flexible enough to allow railroad tracks to bend to be able to stay connected to the ship as a train rolls on and off the ship, causing the ship to not only go up and down but left and right. So the concept of how you create a loading apron that will allow that to happen was even challenging. And that's one of the reasons that those loading aprons, one of the last of those structures to be intact on the property, carried National Historic Landmark status as well. And there was an attempt locally to try to preserve one of those, even use it as just a little bridge to drive, you know, over to get into the park, so that people could always have an appreciation for that amazing technology that really came into practical use for the first time here in Alberta. It's Alberta's claim to national fame, but we don't have much to show for it here anymore.
Almost international fame too, right? Because I heard that the Russians came over prior, even during the Tsar's period, came over to see what was going on, right? How that was working.
Yep, that technology was duplicated all over the world.
Yeah. And was this, I like to think of it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I like to think of it, is this the beginning really of container ships? It's pretty close, isn't it?
In terms of containerized cargo management, I suppose it would be.
There were no container ships at that time.
Correct.
And we're back. And we're speaking with
Jed Jaworski, Rover.
Yeah, it was my friends and colleagues with the band Song of the Lakes that we organized to help interpret maritime history at the museum then that coined that phrase of Ben Z. Rover. But having listened to that old Gordon Lightfoot tune with its maritime twist, it brings back a lot of memories of working on the ferries, when we would have to head out into the kind of weather that probably many local folks have experienced here this winter if you happen to drive to the turn around and...
But we didn't experience it crossing the lake.
Yep, that's exactly where I'm going with this. It was a whole different experience. And people are looking at the waves crashing over the top of the lighthouse tower and not even able to open the door in their cars to get out to snap a picture because of the wind. And those are the kinds of days when even if we were enjoying the protection of being in Frankfurt Harbor aboard the ship, we would have to sail out into, because at a certain point, the swell coming up the channel would get into the bay, and we were unable to hold the ferries at the docks. There have been many times when the off-watch people, of course, go uptown, the on-watch people load the ship, and they wait for the call whistle. But when it's blowing and clearly poor weather to cross the lake, there's a good chance we're going to lay in port for a while. So everybody, you know, goes to what they're going to do, and many folks would always go to Pea Soup's, what's now the Mayfair Tavern.
Yeah.
Everyone was merrymaking there because nobody thought we were going to get called to go back out onto the lake, but it got so difficult to hold the ship at the dock that the mate on watch blew the call whistle. And we could tell just by the way the whistle was blown, there was a sense of urgency to it. When I got back down to the ship, the cables were already snapping. And the ship was disconnected from the apron because it was starting to destroy the apron. The apron couldn't keep up with the rising and falling of the ship and the surge coming up the channel because we were in the West Slip. This was aboard the Viking. So there was a great urgency in getting everyone aboard, and we literally had to jump when the ship got close to the apron to get on the stern of the ship. And then out you go into the kind of storm that would sink the Edmund Fitzgerald. You know, we'd go about 90 revolutions per minute, just enough to keep headway. And I often worked as a wheelsman, and you literally would have to steer a ship as big as the Viking, 350 feet, into each wave, just like you would a small motorboat on a stormy day. And sometimes, despite your best efforts, with the mate or the captain at the throttle and the wheelsman making the best possible approach to that large breaking sea, that ship would drop off the top of that wave and come crashing down, and you would just hear this tremendous... They call it hitting a stump because the cresting wave would slap against the flat sides of the ship. The ferry doesn't have much flare in the bow because you need to get the boxcars as far forward in the ship as possible. So if the wave hits that flat side of that bow just right, it's like somebody hitting that boat with a giant baseball bat. And then you could hear the sound of the jacks holding the boxcars up. You'd hear them drop, some come loose. So in that kind of conditions, no one got any sleep. It was all hands on deck. The deck crew would be constantly putting the jacks and the chains and the wrappers, clamps, onto these cars to try to hold them still, because the worst thing that could possibly happen is have a box car or a string of cars come loose. That's always been the fate of any ferry. So it was... It was a long, very nerve-wracking trip. Normally, it takes 4 hours to get across the lake in weather like that. It could easily take, you know, 8-12 hours to finally get to the protection of the Wisconsin shoreline, where, you know, we would often just go back and forth up and down the coast until the weather could finally break and we could come back. There was one occasion on the Viking when Chuck Novak was skipper. We came back over to the Michigan side, and we tried to shoot straight for Frankfurt, but because the waves were so large, we ended up off of Sleeping Bear Dune. And so we would have to turn and briefly go back into the waves and then turn again to get into Frankfurt Harbor. But the waves were just mountainous, and they were actually sloshing over the back of the ship. And you could see Sleeping Bear Dune had changed from its normal warm sandy glow to a cold, snow-covered winter face.
An ice mountain.
Because this actually was a November 11th Armistice Day blow. The Marine office in Frankfort was trying to urge the ship to come in because freight was piling up. We needed to get, you know, the storm was supposedly abating. We needed to get freight moving again. So the Marine Superintendent Bill Bacon was pleading with Captain Novak to try to get into the harbor. He says, I'm only showing occasional gusts of 25 miles an hour here in the harbor. And both Chuck and I looked at the wind speed indicator in the pilot house of the Viking, and it was 57 miles an hour. But he felt he could do it. So I was taken off the wheel because I was not a highly experienced wheelsman at that juncture. And they brought up a fellow by the name of Guy Reed, who'd wheeled that boat ever since he was a young man. And I remember Guy Reed was always super chill, quiet, never rattled kind of guy. And he had a big mustache, like back in the old logging days. And I remember standing in the wheelhouse, and it was so quiet when we were getting ready to make that, pick our wave, basically, to surf into Frankfort Harbor on a 350-foot ship. I could hear Guy Reed breathing heavy through his mustache. So I was like, yeah, even he's a little white-knuckled on this one.
A little cracking.
And you could see at the top of the Alberta Overlook and at the Frankfort turnaround, it was absolutely packed with cars and people all waiting to see us either safely enter the harbor or witness a devastating marine casualty. But it always felt good to kind of see the community turn out for the boats. You know, sometimes working as a mariner, you just kind of feel like you're totally out of the loop. But there was something a little heartwarming when you'd come off a stormy Lake Michigan and see a huge number of your townsfolk, crossing their fingers and wishing you well to get into the safety of the harbor again. And then, of course, many winter experiences where, you know, you spend a long, cold night locked in the ice out on Lake Michigan. There was one time with the city of Milwaukee, which had less horsepower than the Viking, so we were a little more vulnerable on the ice, although certainly more comfortable on board. But the Lake Michigan was very still for like four January, bitter cold January nights. And Lake Michigan froze over to where you could almost ice skate from. It was just flat sheet ice, which was unusual. But every now and then, you know, when the wind starts to pick up, what's called a windrow forms. And these are areas of the ice that are weak, and then they pressure fracture and the ice is driven up. So you'll be breaking 2 foot thick sheet ice, and then you'll suddenly get to a place where that sheet ice is now piled 12 or even 14 feet high. And there's a lot of pressure in that ridge in addition to the extra ice. And we tried breaking through one of those on the city of Milwaukee, and we got about halfway through, and you could actually feel the ship almost be like grabbed to a sudden stop. And we were like, oh boy, that didn't feel good. And sure enough, we were stuck. We couldn't get out of there. And to make matters worse, the pressure ridge started to tilt the ship. And on a steamboat, that's a problem because then the water flows away from the boiler fire. And at some point, if you take on too much of a list, you have to shut the boilers down and the ship has to go cold and dark. So we had called for help, but unfortunately the Viking was just getting into Frankfort and had to reload and then come back out across three quarters of the way across the lake to get to us. And then that next day the Viking got to us and broke us out. And we all got in, unloaded in Wisconsin. Then coming back across the lake, the wind had really picked up out of the west and it blew all the ice in to the west or Michigan shore. And it forced the ice down. When you get a high wind out of the west, the ice just keeps piling up. And as it breaks, it just keeps forcing itself down deeper into the water. So you can end up with what looks like surface ice, but it's actually like a solid snow cone. It's just like slushy, big chunks of ice. And so the Viking went charging into the harbor first, having the most horsepower. And we watched as the bow just kind of came up but then didn't fall back down, which is an indication of slush ice. And we could see him, the ship trembling, trying to back out of that, but they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, there's always some friendly rivalry between the two ships, and the more powerful Viking is always making fun of the slower steamboat City of Milwaukee. But now here we were in a position just a few hours later to break the Viking out. So we backed, you know, grinding the ice in the propellers, kept backing up to the Viking, a few times getting stuck ourselves, but we eventually got them out. They then backed out, and Captain Bruce Jewell, the Viking, being the kind of guy he is, he's like, I've got the most powerful ship. I'm going to get into the harbor. He charges at it again, and this time is really stuck. So we go to try to get him out, and then we get stuck. And now both ships are stuck fast in the ice and very close, if the wind should shift, to being driven into the break walls or being taken aground. So at that juncture, a call was made for Coast Guard icebreaking assistance. And they sent down the Coast Guard cutter Acacia, which is now a museum ship next to the City of Milwaukee, down in Manistee.
Mm-hmm.
And the Acacia came, and I remember being in the pilot house of the City of Milwaukee, and when we first had radio communication with the Acacia, we realized that the captain had a Texas drawl to his voice. And I remember the captain and I looking at one another going, a Texan, that's probably not good for ice breaking. And sure enough, the Acacia showed up, and he asked, at that time we had gotten loose, and we were able to at least keep moving and not get locked in. And he asked us to shut down. He said he felt too nervous, us moving around, if he was coming in for close ice breaking operations. And we said, if we stop moving, we're stuck, we're done, you know. But he ordered us, and in that situation, the Coast Guard's calling the shots. So we shut down, we got hopelessly stuck in the ice, and about that same time, the Acacia got hopelessly stuck in the ice. And they immediately got squeezed out of the water, so they had to go to a cold, dead ship, no heat, you know, only an emergency generator. So then the Coast Guard sent the tug Raritan down, and we had to wait for that ship. But that was a powerful ice-breaking tug with a very experienced Great Lakes ice-breaking captain, and he was able to first free the Viking. Then he got the City of Milwaukee out, and then he broke loose the Acacia, which refueled us offshore because we were running out of bunker fuel.
Could people on shore witness all this action?
I was going to say, it was
quite a show.
that used to be some pretty solid entertainment for a lot of local folks, watching the plight of the ships in the ice, because usually that was played out right offshore. The ice was almost always worse. Right on the, because of prevailing west and northwesterly winds, most of the ice-breaking drama happened within view of the Alberta Overlook or Frankfurt Turnaround.